This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, this is Sean Illing. I write for Vox about politics and philosophy.
And I'm Jamil Smith. I write for Vox about identity, culture, and civil rights.
And we're going to be your regular hosts for Vox Conversations. Starting July 12th, Vox Conversations will be coming to you twice a week. I'll be your host every Monday.
And on Thursdays, you'll hear episodes hosted by me. And from time to time, you'll also hear from other colleagues at Vox and beyond.
You'll still be hearing interesting, deep conversations with smart and talented people with all sorts of different areas of expertise from diverse fields and backgrounds like you have been all year.
But you'll get more of them. And these episodes won't be generic, run-of-the-mill interviews. They're going to be conversations. Sean and I are going to bring some of ourselves to each discussion that we bring to you.
Yeah, that's part of what we think makes Vox Conversations a different kind of podcast. So maybe we should get to know each other a little bit.
Sure.
So, Jamil, I kind of know you, but I don't really know you yet. So I'm actually genuinely curious how you came to be a journalist. Did you set out to be one, or did you, like me, stumble into this profession?
Somewhat. Yeah. I would say, you know, I was brought into journalism, very early. I was a 13-year-old kid who wanted to write for the school paper at Shaker Heights High School. And I'm writing for the paper, and I'm understanding the value of journalism, but it's very kind of impersonal at that point. And then when I was 15 years old, my cousin was murdered, and he had been missing for a long time. And, you know, when I didn't see anything in the paper about him, any kind of mentions, obituaries, no, hey, you know, we're looking for this guy, nothing. I said to myself, you know what, I have to tell the stories of people who are not getting their stories told. And I know it sounds like a very ennobling thing to do, but it's honestly something that empowers my work. And I'm trying to, you know, make sure that the underrepresented, like Andre, have their story told. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Mm.
Someone has to decide whose story gets told and who doesn't. It really matters.
And that's why it's important that people with diverse experiences be in our business. Because yes, yeah. I followed the, good school to an Ivy League college route. And, you know, people may look at that, you know, sort of on paper and say, well, you know, how would he know about anything? And it's true. There's a lot I don't know about. My parents grew up in the projects. I have no idea what that was like. But I do this work so I can listen to people. Like, that's part of what conversations are, man. It's not just us talking. It's us listening.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was a columnist in college, and I just, like, everything that's going on with this guy named Barack Obama, who's running for president for the first time. And I said, you know, gosh, I would love to be able to write about this stuff. And I was encouraged by my loved ones to start a blog. And I started a blog that no one was reading. And one of the folks who followed me was one Dr. Rachel Maddow. And I, very long story short, I ended up as a member of her production team. I was also writing for her site. So that helped introduce me back into the dream of, you know, that 13-year-old who wanted to be a columnist at the New York Times.
What do you care most about as a writer and a thinker and a citizen, really?
I care most about people being critical thinkers about the world around them. I care about having intellectually honest conversations and debate. I don't care about agreeing all the time with people. That is not something I actually hope to do. Ever since I had this college column at the Daily Pennsylvanian, I've always wanted to inspire debate, to get people thinking about what's going on in the world, what we can do better, specifically in this country. I mean, think about how unfinished America is. We have to continue to make changes, alterations, and rethink the institutions that have been built around us so that they can better serve us. And so I believe very strongly that there are fundamentally good ideas at the heart of the American experiment, articulated now and then by very flawed people. And that's fine. Like, we can get through that if we work together and we listen to one another. And that's the thing about conversation. It's not simply about the person speaking. It's about the person listening. And we have to be active listeners. I'm not an overly optimistic person when it comes to, you know, turning the clock back on injustices, but I'm not going to be a pessimist. I think a lot back to that James Baldwin quote. I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. I'm here. And so while I'm here, I'm going to try to do everything I can to make sure that people understand the problems of the world and how we can confront them. Mm. Well, Sean, I'm just as curious about how you got started. Having read you for a long time, how did you first, you know, come into journalism? How did you develop the passion for interviewing and for conversations that you have?
Well, my road to journalism was very weird and winding. And, you know, I went to graduate school. I wanted to be a professor. I taught politics and philosophy for a couple of years, but it didn't work out the way I had hoped. And if anyone out there knows anything about the academic job market, that requires no further explanation. So, like you, I actually had started a very dumb blog back in 2015 at the encouragement of my wife, or then girlfriend, now wife. You know, I was living in Louisiana, and basically all I did there was dunk on Bobby Jindal, who was my objectively terrible governor at the time, mostly about politics, and I was writing a lot. I mean, it was really just blogging. Mm. And then one day I got an email from Ezra Klein about an interview writer's position at Vox, and I had no idea what the hell an interviews writer position even was. Do you do interviews or do you write? What's the difference? But, you know, what I told Ezra the day I interviewed for this job in his office, you know, I told him, I'm probably not even qualified for this position. In fact, I know I'm not qualified for this position. I'm not really a journalist. I've just been kind of playing one on the side for a year or so. But I told him I'll learn and I'll do it the only way I can. And, you know, I think that's true today, you know, 4.5, 5 years later, as it was then, weird as that may sound. What I try to do, what I've always tried to do, is approach this job with as much doubt and curiosity as possible. You know, I came, you know, from the world of ideas. I was a political theorist. You know, that's what I studied. And, you know, that's kind of how I approach basically everything I talk or write about. I mean, there's the thing we're talking about, and then there are the kind of deep abstract questions floating above and beneath that thing or those things. And I'm trying to get at that. You know, sometimes I succeed, sometimes I fuck it up, but that's my goal. That's what I try to do.
Yeah. What did you learn about interviewing when you started that job that you didn't know before, or maybe something that surprised you?
I learned how to listen. For a lot of my life, I was a much better talker than I was a listener. And I think that was a real handicap in all kinds of ways I never realized or recognized. And, you know, once I started getting paid to talk to people, I learned how important it was to listen, because if you don't listen, the conversation is flat and dead and you miss a lot of opportunities.
You mentioned that you were teaching. How did your background help prepare you for this particular career step?
You know, that's interesting. You know, I'm on the left. I don't hide that. Anyone who follows my work knows that, you know, but I'm also annoyingly heterodox in a lot of my political views. I mean, I try as much as possible to not be a prisoner of dogmas. And I think I'm a little skeptical of elite consensus. I'm not totally sure why that is, but I'm sure it has something to do with the fact that, you know, I grew up in the Deep South. I grew up in Biloxi, Mississippi, all the way down on the Gulf Coast. This is as red states get. I went to shitty public schools. I was mostly a terrible student. I was constantly in trouble. I eventually, you know, joined the military when I was 18 to kind of reboot my life because I was sort of careening out of control. And I say all that not because I presume anyone really cares, but I do think it informs who I am as a journalist in probably all kinds of ways. You know, I hope that my experiences give me some kind of perspective that is maybe a little underrepresented at this level. And I brought that to, you know, the classroom, and I hope I bring that to, you know, my writing and my interviews.
Speaking of which, I know that you have been hosting this podcast for some time now.
Yeah.
As the new guy, I would love to know, how is this podcast different than other interview podcasts?
Well, look, I don't want to be an asshole and say it's the best. that's not true. And also, yeah, I don't think like that. I mean, to the extent that it's different because we're hosting. And, you know, while the show has never been about me, or the shows I've been on have never been about me, I bring my whole self to it. And something I've tried to do is model vulnerability and openness. You know, there's a tendency to perform these things on a show like this. And I hope to not do that. But I'm also interrogating. You know, I don't want to preach. I want to probe. I want to have hard, good faith exchanges. And sometimes, you know, that'll lead to uncomfortable places. And that's good. If I have someone on the show I disagree with, the presumption is that there's something to learn from that person. And that's what I'm looking for. And when there's disagreement, well, there's disagreement, you know. But the guiding principle for me, really in my life, is that I'm never entirely sure, really, about anything. Mm-hmm. And so even my strongest convictions are always floating on a shaky foundation. I don't try to hide that. I hope that comes through in the show.
Yeah, it sounds like to a large extent, what you're talking about is vulnerability and the need for both subject and interviewer, or I guess, you know, in this case, both conversationalists to have vulnerability, to exhibit that, and to know what you don't know. That's actually one of the best things about journalism is that they pay you to learn. and
it's amazing, isn't it?
It is great. I mean, you know, and you don't have to be in academia. It's, it's I'm sure you're relieved about. But
you just have to write better.
Oh, my mother's a professor, so I won't go on the record about that one. I definitely think that it's absolutely vital. I think it's vital for really any human relationship to have vulnerability, to be open, to take a risk that you could be, I guess, either wrong, humiliated, shown up. I mean, all the kind of different things that we don't want to experience. We have to make sure that we're available for that if we're going to have an open conversation where we might actually learn something.
Yeah, you know, when I started this, I was very self-conscious and I really wanted to be seen as smart and clever. That gets in the way of that kind of honesty and vulnerability that we're talking about. And as I've gotten a little more comfortable, I've let some of those, you know, neuroses go. And, you know, that's one of the things I love about doing a podcast. It's okay to step in it sometimes. You know, you're not writing a 5,000 word fact-checked feature. You're just talking. And talking is awkward and clumsy. But so is thinking.
Right.
And that's all right.
And I mean, I love actually listening to people think. And if you can actually do that. I mean, it's especially in the audio world, you know, long, awkward pauses are not something that people necessarily want to hear. When I've listened to this show and when I've just thought about what makes a good conversation, the key elements to me always are being present and being authentic. I just think that's something that's worthy of praise and recognition, not disparagement. I want that person to take their time and figure it out.
So now that you're on board, Jamil, I'm curious, you know, what you plan to bring to your conversations that is distinctly you and yours.
I think people who have read my writing understand that I approach subjects with a perspective, certainly, but also with an openness to learn. And I think back to an interview I did a couple years ago when I was a senior writer at Rolling Stone and I was an MC at the Chicago Ideas Week. Sat on stage with J.D. Vance, the author of Hillbilly Elegy and now a Senate candidate in my home state of Ohio. And he and I disagree about a lot. I didn't care for his book. But me coming out there and telling him, look, J.D., I didn't like your book. I don't like your politics. There's nowhere to go from there. That's not interesting even to me.
Right.
I've learned that that kind of conversation really serves the interviewer, I guess, in an egotistical sense, more so than it serves any audience. And I tried to approach it by acknowledging that we were two Ohio boys just sitting here having a conversation and lighten the mood a little bit, relate on a human level. Pretty much everyone you can talk to, you can find something that you can relate to one another about, and you can find something that that person knows that you don't. And that could be everyone from President Biden to Republican leadership to our foremost scholars to the man on the street. If you approach every conversation with the idea and the knowledge that you have things to learn from one another, even if you disagree, there's something for you to talk about.
Yeah. Amen.
And another thing I learned from that J.D. Vance experience is that gotcha interviews are pretty useless unless you're just trying maybe to get ratings. So I'm more into understanding whatever ideas this person who I'm speaking with has. And whether or not I think those ideas are valid or substantiated, it's something for us to talk about. It's something for us to engage our audience about so that they can go, hopefully, and take what they've listened to into their own lives and start talking with the people in their life about that particular idea. And if people are listening to this and don't talk about or think about what we've discussed in our conversations, then I think we haven't accomplished our mission.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, gotcha interviews aren't just useless. They're also boring. And everything interesting comes from the collision of ideas, good and bad or otherwise. You know, even when I talk to someone who I think has bad ideas, and there will be many I talk to who I think have bad ideas, I think there is something useful to be teased out of colliding with that bad idea and challenging that bad idea and not challenging it from a place of certainty, but challenging it from a place of genuine curiosity. And so as much as possible, you know, we'll try to be the anti-Twitter here and try not to have, you know, bite-sized conversations and really try to chew on the ideas themselves, not the bullshit that tends to percolate around them.
Exactly. Now, there are ideas that are not productive, and I get that. You have to choose your time wisely, but I think it's really important that our audience stay curious, and I think that's on us to make sure that that happens.
Yeah. Jamil, what do you think makes for a good conversation?
I think the empathy has to be involved. I mean, I used to say to a friend all the time, he said, you know, when you know stuck in LA traffic and you look around at the people in their cars and some people are rocking out, some people are, you know, having loud conversations on the phone, some people are just kind of sitting there bored, and said, everyone's having a different day. And you don't know what a person is going through. You don't know what a person has dealt with. You don't know what they're enduring. Part of a conversation is learning about that, how it has shaped their viewpoint on the world. And why is that viewpoint something that we need to be taking note of? What about you?
Openness, authenticity, curiosity. I think certainty is a conversation killer. You know, a good conversation goes in surprising directions because the people involved are alive to what's being said and they're open to movement. Are you there to be informed or are you there to be affirmed? I think if you're in a genuine conversation, you're there to be informed, to listen and learn, not to just win a debate or score a point in a debate.
So what are you planning? What do you think we can tell the audience what to expect over these next few weeks?
You know, I hope to have hard conversations, weird conversations, fun conversations, surprising conversations. You know, some shows will be heavy, some will be light, but you know, my aim will always be to find the deeper questions animating the broader conversation. And ideally, we will very rarely land in a place of certainty because the biggest questions, the most interesting questions, don't admit of simple answers. But we can learn a lot by exploring all the possible answers. We have lots of like really interesting people coming on, thoughtful people from, you know, Fareed Zakaria to Liz Brunig to Michael Pollan or many, many others. Yeah. Those are just mine. You've got a whole catalog of great guests yourself too. Yeah.
KSA Lehman, Chris Bosch, Larry Krasner.
Yeah, right. So I think we're going to do our best to make those conversations fresh and distinct and most of all, not boring, because boredom is the only unpardonable sin in this business. So yeah, we'll not commit that. What about you? What are you thinking?
I mean, to me, the key to making sure that you avoid boredom is to have some fun with it. Mm-hmm. I definitely feel like I'm about to have some fun talking to people who, you know, some of whom I've always wanted to talk to, quote unquote, but I've also some people I've never really thought I would ever have a chance to talk with. So we're going to explore things that sometimes are deep and dark and terrible, but at the same time, shine some light in there as well. I can imagine if I'm going to talk to the Philadelphia district attorney about crime and wrongful convictions and mass incarceration. Yeah, I mean, that seems like a really heavy listen. But at the same time, just know that we're also going to have some fun. There will be some laughs. There will be some lighter moments. Because even in these moments of despair that we're dealing with in this news cycle, there's still moments where we can all relate to one another in ways that maybe we didn't anticipate. And that's honestly what I'm going to be going in search of.
Absolutely. I mean, I went into philosophy instead of science, both because I suck at math and also because I'm just genuinely more interested in the questions than the answers. I always have been. And, you know, I invite people to listen to the show and to listen to me ask as many questions as I can and follow the many potential answers wherever they lead.
Yeah. Be sure to subscribe to Vox Conversations wherever you get your podcasts.
And look for new episodes starting July 12th.